Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the Fast Forward Radio Archives on Blog Talk Radio. This is Phil Bauermaster welcoming you to this program, which originally aired November 18th, 2007. This is a very special program for us. This is the first appearance of Brian Wong on Fast Forward Radio. Brian, of course, is a great friend of this program and has been a frequent guest over the years, someone we always look forward to talking to, someone who always has interesting things to say, new things to say, things we've not heard before, on a huge variety of topics, from nanotechnology to new energy to human enhancement to economics to just about any subject you can name. And this program was no exception. The topic was human enhancement for this particular program, although nanotechnology and some of these other areas obviously are addressed. This week we've got a full schedule. We'll be on live Wednesday evening, and we'll be back on Saturday evening with the next segment of The World Transformed, The End of Scarcity, and The Age of Abundance. Hope you'll be able to join us for all of our upcoming programs, and I hope you'll enjoy our first ever interview with Brian Wong, which begins right now. And until next time, live to see it. Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. As with the blog, Fast Forward Radio is about the future. It's about accelerating change, emerging technologies. It's about all things futuristic with a positive twist. And I know of no one more positive than my co-blogger and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen. How are you?
Well, thanks, Phil, for that introduction. Actually, I got to say that I've got a cold tonight, but I'm gonna get through the show this evening. I got some tea here, and I'm gonna drink it when I need to, and mute myself when I go into a coughing fit. And so we're gonna get through the show just fine.
See, there's that whole positive thing.
That's right. Right
there. And I wanted to tell you, you know, coming off that intro, when I say we do the future with a positive twist, I could just as easily have said, "I know of no one more twisted," and gone right into the intro to you.
And you would have been just as accurate. So that's
no. But here at Fast Forward Radio, we're all about taking the high road.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't go for the cheap, obvious cheap shots. We go for the difficult, subtle cheap shots.
That's right.
If we're going to use them at all. So we've got a fantastic show lined up tonight. Hope you're feeling well enough to get through the whole thing. We've got Brian Wang will be joining us shortly in our second segment. We'll be talking to him about human augmentation and a couple of other interesting, fun, new features that we'll be trotting out this week. But let's start with the basics. I think that there might be some birthday greetings in order. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, last week you got the kitchen pass to get on the show, even though it was your anniversary. And
That's right.
I appreciate your wife for being a good sport. My wife is the good sport this weekend. It is her birthday. And
today is Sherilyn's birthday. So
yeah, and so
happy
she's
birthday to her, and she has allowed you to take this time out of her birthday and do a podcast.
That's right. That's right. We've married good sports, both of us, and so happy birthday to her.
Happy birthday, Sherilyn. Absolutely. And she's she's a speculous widow, as is Soraya so often. But we need to compare notes at some time, because I believe I mentioned that my kitchen involved both jewelry and flowers. So I'd like to know what was required on your part. We'll take that offline, though. That's not
that's right. Well, it's, the closest to jewelry we got was Ruby Tuesday, I think. But anyway,
well, that could be good too. Yeah,
yeah, that's a pretty good restaurant. So we had a good time celebrating her birthday earlier today. So, yeah, want to get into a little sporting news. LSU.
On that one, yeah. What do you got for us? What's going on with LSU this week?
I got to be excited about my home team. They're doing awesome. Ole Miss is a good. They have a good ball. They have a good team this year, and they played good ball yesterday. But LSU was just so strong, particularly their defense, that they ended up. I mean, the score doesn't tell how well Ole Miss played. It was the ending score is 41-24.
That's a blowout.
Yeah, it sounds like a blowout, but really Ole Miss played hard, and LSU is just that strong. I hope that they don't get cocky though, because they're playing a tough team next week, and Arkansas.
Who are they up against next week?
Arkansas, and so this will be interesting. Of course, they're on home turf, and there is no home turf that is as tough in college ball as LSU's. For visiting
teams. So they got that going for them.
Yeah, so.
So we've been tracking LSU ever since, you know, the Rockies were still in the World Series. So this has been an ongoing theme here for us on the program. What's the bowl picture looking like? Is that figured out for them yet, or they still have a few games to play before that's going to come into focus?
I don't know. It's been announced yet. In visiting with family members that keep up, I mean, with the minutia of college ball better than I do, they were saying that it was still possible for LSU to miss being in a bowl, even though they're ranked number one, if they were to lose the rest of their games. That was as of, you know, just before the game yesterday. So I guess if they won yesterday's game, they're definitely in a bowl, and so probably someone who knows college ball very, very closely could tell us what bowl they're going to be in, but I don't know.
Okay, well,
so
maybe someone will call in and tell us, or we'll have it figured out by next week. I've got a lot less to report on the Colorado side of sports. The Broncos don't play until Monday Night Football tomorrow night. They're up against Tennessee. And the Colorado Buffs are only just playing this evening, so I don't have in any of the two big ones. Although we had talked a little bit about Air Force last week, the Air Force Academy, of course, located in Colorado Springs, so I'm counting them as a Colorado school because they are one.
Yeah,
speaking of blocks, they beat San Diego State 55-23. So.
Well, that's great. Now, last week they had a game that they won, obviously, but it wasn't quite the matchup that this one was.
Wasn't anything like that. Yeah, you know, San Diego State, big rivalry there, I think, although they're not having that hot of a season. And now Air Force is sitting on 9-3, so this is
that's not bad at all, is it?
Maybe we'll be talking a bowl for Air Force as well, but we'll pick that up next week. Meanwhile, moving swiftly on through topics from sports, let's go to entertainment. Stephen, have you seen any good movies lately?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've seen a great movie. I don't want to give too much away. It's Beowulf. Of course, if you went all the way through high school and then to college and had any lit classes, you probably read the poem.
Or the
Cliff Notes for the poem, because the poem was indecipherable in the Old English. It was actually quite faithful to the poem, except for in one particular. And Phil, you'd actually complained to me in an email about it, and that was Angelina Jolie's portrayal of Grendel's mother. Angelina Jolie, of course, is a beautiful woman. And some lists, I think that she's like number one among famous women in the world as far as her beauty, right? She plays Grendel's mother, and of course Grendel's mother in the original poem was a horrible monster. Well, obviously she was playing this monster as, obviously as sexy and as desirable. Well, that completely changed the story, but I think it may have changed the story in a positive way, and it might have actually improved on the story. And I don't want to give anything away more than what I already have, but I think you just need to go see it, Phil. And I think the plot changes actually improve the story. And you'll have to see it and tell me if you agree.
Well, let me just sidebar production note about Fast Forward Radio before I respond to all of what you just said. As I had mentioned in the on the blog, I'm trying out calling in from my Vonage phone tonight for the first time. So I was actually trying to respond to you with thoughts on this whole Angelina Jolie thing, and you couldn't hear me.
Okay.
And you were just carrying on talking, and I think it was the ideal situation for you, Stephen, because nothing I said was slowing you down in the least. So.
Well, go ahead.
Coming back on, I missed a little of what you said, but it sounds like a perfect setup actually for a movie, because you got, I mean, cast wise, this is good stuff. You got Anthony Hopkins as Hrothgar. You got Crispin Glover as Grendel. That's inspired. I mean, it's not only these actors. It's actually CGI of these actors playing these characters.
Yeah, motion captured is what they did. The last big movie that I'm aware of that they did that was Tom Hanks that Christmas movie. What was that? Anyway.
Arctic Express, the Polar Express.
That's it. And they did motion capture for that CGI movie, but this was, they did it again, and I'm telling you, there's a thing called the Uncanny Valley what they're trying to do is they're trying to make CGI characters look photorealistic, as if, you know, they're in the real world. And the problem with the Uncanny Valley is that it's almost creepy. Okay, you see something that looks real, but it's not quite right, and it's kind of creeping you out. Well, that's the Uncanny Valley. They almost have crossed it with this movie. It's a lot better in that regard than the Polar Express was.
So by saying we've crossed the Uncanny Valley, you're saying we're out of it now. That
we're getting close to being out of it. There were moments that the Uncanny Valley was present in Beowulf, but it's better than Happy Feet. The people that they showed in Happy Feet. It's better than the Polar Express. It's the best CGI of actual people. It's photorealistic that I've seen on film.
Okay, well that's something to look forward to, and it's an interesting problem that animation can be not that great and we're okay with it.
Yeah, we're fine with that.
It can be almost too good, and then we have a problem, but then it gets a little better, and then the problem starts to go away, because at that point you're almost looking at a photorealistic image.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, we got no problem watching Mickey Mouse cartoons. You know, we're not,
right.
You know, this is not supposed to be the real world, but once they try to get into the real world and make something look photorealistic, it can be kind of creepy and not quite right, but this movie had a little bit of that, but it was a minor thing, and didn't really take away from the enjoyment of the movie at all.
Okay, good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to make a point of going to see it, and we'll, you know, look forward to maybe chatting about it again after I've got some info on it.
Oh, absolutely.
But now I want to move to yet another segment. We're getting in several things here quickly, so we can leave plenty of time to talk to Brian in our second and third segments. But, you know, one of the things I've observed about our program, and it's similar to our blog, is that very few topics are off limits for us. On The Speculist, we generally shy away from politics and we shy away from religion, primarily because those are topics that tend to become all-consuming for blog. And if you spend a lot of time with those, then, you know, you're gonna end up spending all your time on those. So we don't write about those too much. But anything else that we can get a future angle on, we'll pretty much talk about it. And so I've noticed on this show, we've become kind of the jack of all trades radio show. We do sports, we do movie reviews. We just had one, right? We've got little segments similar to MythBusters, where we're talking about using baby powder to kill ants, right? Checking on those kinds of things. And tonight we're going to introduce a new kind of segment, and this goes back to kind of the origins of both The Speculist and Fast Forward Radio, because one of the topics that we shy away from is what I call the Art Bell material, the kind of material that you would hear on Coast to Coast AM, which actually a favorite radio show. I think that you've probably listened to it a time or two yourself. Is that right, Stephen?
Absolutely, and I count it as an inspiration for this Fast Forward Radio. You know, listening to that, you know, in the middle of the night while driving, I was thinking, you know, it'd be great if we could do something like that, but actually have it based in reality.
Right. So our show is an attempt to deal with subjects as interesting as that and as far out potentially as some of those topics, but be grounded thoroughly in reality, which doesn't preclude us occasionally dealing with the very kinds of topics that they deal with on Coast to Coast. And that's why, starting tonight, we're going to have an occasional segment that I like to call
Tales of the Paranormal.
Tales of the Paranormal.
Tales of the Paranormal.
So I've actually written a blog post on the subject of the odd, very strange, very mysterious connection between myself and the planet Mars. I think you've had a chance to read over that, so I'm not going to attempt to recreate it all here on the on the broadcast tonight, seeing as we've got so many other topics that we want to get into this evening. So
and I want to go ahead and let you know, Phil, that that our guest has called in.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so
we'll be switching to our interview with Brian here shortly. I just wanted to say that there is an astounding, I think you'll agree, Stephen, astounding set of coincidences that add up between myself and the planet Mars.
Yeah, no doubt.
Ending with photographic evidence that I personally, speaking of uncanny, would describe as uncanny. I don't know what word you would describe, but to me, it's surreal and mind blowing. Would those words be accurate, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so with that in mind, I'm just going to tell everyone there's a weird connection between me and the planet Mars. That does it for this time, and we'll look forward to picking up another weird topic on the next edition of...
Okay, well, let's try it again. Here we go. Sorry for that delay there, Phil. That's the fuzzy-headed cold there. Let's bring our guest in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're delighted to bring Brian Wang onto the show. Brian is a California-based futurist. He is a member of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology Task Force, and he's an advisor to the Nanoethics Group. He's also an advisor to the Lifeboat Foundation and was a senior associate of the Foresight Institute from 1997 to 2006, where he helped run the 2003 Foresight Institute organization relaunch plan. He is also listed as a big thinker with Kurzweil AI, and I should note that he got listed as one back when that meant something, back before they started being anybody like yours truly up there. So so that is a real honor. Brian, we are delighted to have you here. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Outstanding. So we've been looking over some topics that that we could get into with you this evening, and I think the one that kind of stands out that we thought we'd spend some time on is to talk about human augmentation. And you had written kind of an extensive email to Stephen and myself talking about some of the choices that people are facing in terms of, and I would say individuals and collectively that we're facing, in terms of kinds of things that we can do to augment ourselves physically and mentally, and the problems that currently exist with those. So maybe we could take just a few minutes and talk about what are the technologies that people are currently using to augment some of the problems associated with that.
Well, I think the most famous ones that people are using are steroids and cosmetic surgery. There's 3 million people that are using steroids now, but only 1 in 5 are using it for athletic reasons. I think more like 4 in 5 are just using it for appearance, which also goes to the cosmetic surgery aspect of things, that people are taking surgery and steroids, which have downsides to health and to risk. Like there was a recent death of the mother of one of the rappers, whatever, because of cosmetic surgery. But people are still doing this by the million, 3 million for steroids in the U.S. alone, 11 million cosmetic surgery, and primarily these are for vanity. But there's also things like about 1 in 10 students are taking things like Adderall or Provigil, drugs that enhance concentration for better test scores. Some people say they can boost your SAT score by 200 points, which would be significant for getting to university.
Wow. Now, is there good solid research to back that up? There's actual scientific evidence that you can get that big of a boost?
I'm not sure how good the scientific evidence is of it, but there seems to be enough anecdotal evidence, enough people believing that they can get it. And, you know, like how much of it is it a placebo effect of, you know, the confidence that they have going into it? Is it just the fact they have a stimulant or some other things going for them that helps them get the better scores? But certainly the students believe that they're getting better scores, and they're taking it like in significant numbers. And the impact on the bottom line is like Adderall sales are up like 3,000% over the previous year or something like that. So it's and Provigil up 350%, something like that. So it's, you know, $1 billion business, and for all these things, and these are still, I think, early versions where you can say, well, how much of an effect is that? And I think coming down the line will be things like gene therapy, other things which have, where the effect will be even more pronounced, more clear, that this is a better version of something that can get better performance.
Hi, Brian. This is Stephen Gordon.
Sure.
It's hard to blame students if there's really evidence that even people who don't have a medical need for something like modafinil or Provigil, if there's some evidence that it improves their test scores, then it's hard to blame them from trying it, isn't it?
Right.
And at some point, we have to wonder, well, you know, do we try to regulate it, or is it something that can actually, you know, what are the side effects and how serious are those, and do we just allow it to happen?
My belief is that we should just get safer versions of these things. I'm pretty sure that things like Adderall, Provigil probably are fairly safe because they've had to go through the old, you know, FDA approval thing, the phase, you know, three trials, phase one, phase two, making sure the thing is safe. Of course, they may not be testing against healthy people, but they probably do. So it's probably not super harmful to people. Although certainly if they abuse it, then certainly it could have bad effects. But I think that all the campaigning against steroids and stuff, steroids do have a downside, but one thing that's upcoming is something called myostatin inhibitors, where they had detected some genes in very rare individuals, about like 1 in a million, 1 in 5 million, like that, who have the myostatin protein inhibited, which increases muscle growth. So they've done some recent tests with mice, which show this is four times the effect of steroids, and it stays in the muscles, and they made a drug equivalent of it, and they're testing on humans since 2005 for MS-type diseases. But
Brian, I've heard of there was a young person that was born in Germany, and also I believe one in the United States that was born without the gene for myostatin.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically this, you know, these children, you know, by the time they're 10, they look like they've, you know, they're muscle men. And
right.
But apparently they're not showing any ill effects from it. I don't know. I hadn't heard the latest news on how they're doing, but apparently they're just very strong children.
Right, and I think there even are some adults that they found with it. You know, they end up doing a survey, and once they realized that these kind of people existed, they have found at least 100 around the world to do another study on. The children, the children and the adults seem to just be stronger. They need to eat more protein and some other stuff in order to, and tend to eat a bit more, I think, but that's just because they're supporting more muscle, I would think.
Right.
My thinking on why it didn't get selected for in evolution is that, sure, you're stronger, but in the early days of when you're not sure you're going to get enough food, the guy who needs to eat more, say twice as many calories, he's more vulnerable to starvation. He was stronger, but he starved.
Right.
So I think that the fact that they are stronger now in our society, they wouldn't necessarily have that disadvantage. And the drugs that they're using to mimic that, you could kept it for 3 months, get your 50% boost or whatever, and then go off. So and then you could control it and make it even safer.
And they've been trying. They've been doing human trials for several years now, haven't they? So far so good? Is that the word?
Yeah, that's what seems to be the word is. They haven't released the results. I've been looking at it, but so far it seems to be so far so good. And there's a lot of attention on it. Like all the people who are, a lot of people who are taking the steroids are waiting to try and get this stuff. They're even buying fake myostatin inhibitors at this point. Again, of course, no benefit from that.
The muscle build. I was just glancing at a Muscle and Fitness or something the other day, it was full of ads for various, purported myostatin inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure none of them were true.
Right.
Okay.
But I think that I'm not expecting, because they are, occurring naturally in some people. They occur naturally for some animals, like certain bulls and dogs have the myostatin inhibitor. And, other than the fact they have, in certain cases, they're better sprinters and long-distance runners and that kind of thing, it's not optimizing for everything, right? Like, if you need to be a distance runner, that may not be good for you. But I think that, but beyond the concern for, unlike steroids, the concern about if you get it, then you may be at risk for more tumors or cancer, something like that.
Right.
The myostatin also seems to have other health benefits in that when you're older, it seems to prevent the wasting of muscle for senior citizens. So you can also improve your health with this thing. Any downside effect they have, it seems there may be an offsetting upside in terms of for people who are obese, something like that, they could get on this thing, get more muscle, be able to, and muscle burns more calories than fat. They could help to treat obesity with this kind of thing.
And which in turn could be a treatment, perhaps a preventative for diabetes or even a treatment for diabetes.
That's right.
You could see how that this could be really a blockbuster drug, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's awesome, and hope that we'll hear soon on that. Well, and when these things typically go through this process of being approved, how long does that generally take?
Well, I think sometimes these drug approvals take 17 years. It's a crazy long time. It'd be less if it's something that's considered more natural. I think it could be shortened up. And, of course, this is just the U.S. approval process. I think other places, places in China, Mexico, those kind of things, have far shorter approval periods.
Right.
This is something we talked about last week when we were talking about Jingwei about his treatment for cancer based on immune system, which would require blood transfusions, which is an existing technology. And one of the great things about that was it didn't require FDA approval of a new drug. And it seems like as soon as you get to this place where we've got this great thing that's going to work, now all we have to do is get FDA approval. You're suddenly looking at, as you said, 17 years maybe or more. So you said that if it could be presented in a more natural way, are there alternatives to a drug for inhibiting myostatin?
Well, there is the gene therapy aspect of the thing, but that's probably more complicated. I think if they feel that it's a protein or effect that may be more naturally occurring, I think certain hormone therapy type things where basically you already have it, or most people already have it, then it's you go through fewer hoops because they're saying, okay, it's not like you're taking arsenic or something like that, right? Where
right.
It's something weird which they say, oh, well, let's check that out more because this seems more risky. So I'm not sure, based on that, how long the approvals for this is. I'm thinking because it occurs naturally in some people, even though it's only, say, 1 in a million, that it's still may avoid some of the really long approvals. Plus, my belief is that other countries will fast-track it, and then it'll filter in that way initially. If any delays will just mean it, there'll be this black market for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I wouldn't be the first to be in line for something like this. I don't have a wasting disease. I'm not old yet. But, you know, a few of us, particularly the men among us, would mind having more muscle mass. And, you know, so, yeah, this could really be a blockbuster drug.
Yeah, definitely. I track it. The fact that it necessarily boosts strength, it's a nice effect, and, you know, for certain the ego vanity thing, which we know is a big motivator for people, as I was discussing earlier. I think the main thing for these enhancements of intelligence or strength is enhancements for health and enhancements for productivity. Those are, I think, the main effects that you're looking for in terms of if you have healthier people, it's just better for society and better for the individual. And if you have enhancements for productivity, then it's better for the economy. And that's, I think, more relevant than if you're stronger, because even though people like the comic book type thing of being stronger, you could have used a forklift. So in terms of the effect on the society, it doesn't really matter. Although, you know, there are certain situations where it does, but overall.
Right. The advances that we've made in the last couple hundred years as a species have not been because of our physical strength. Primarily, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what I look at as a futurist, is that when did this thing really make a difference? How does it change society and where we're going? And it's not just because someone else can beat someone up more. It's because they're really affecting the economy, really affecting individual lives.
Well, if it could allow older people to work longer.
That's right.
Not get sick or break bones or things like that.
Or even just be mobile longer.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to get around longer would be a tremendous boost for a lot of people, you would think.
Right. That's when the health really goes down, it's when you actually stop being mobile, like not being able to walk as much. That's when your health just takes a big nosedive.
Right.
Steven, I just want to cut in and mention that for anyone who's just joined us, this is Fast Forward Radio. We're talking with futurist Brian Wang, and we'll be taking calls with Brian on this segment. If anyone has a question for him, they can dial in at 347-215-8972. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. Yeah. Brian, I think you might have been in the middle of saying something.
No, I think I finished. I was just saying the impact, you know, to society and people is more the health productivity thing.
Well, Brian, you had mentioned cosmetic surgery is one of the one of the things that people are doing that's maybe not the approach to meeting to getting to where it is that they want to go. So, what are the technologies that are coming on now that will supplant cosmetic surgery over the next few years?
Well, my belief that most of the cosmetic surgery, well, other than breast augmentation. A lot of those things, like the Botox type things, are to look younger. And what I think will supplant that is things that will help you be younger, live longer. If you actually have effective life extension where you're not getting wrinkly, then that's the thing you want more than just covering up wrinkles. You want something that goes to the root of the problem, and you want to be younger. And I think those kinds of treatments and procedures, I think, are coming down the pike. The ones probably closest would be things that mimic the calorie restriction diet effect, where you have I'm not sure how much you guys have talked about that in previous shows or discussions. Basically, if you eat about 1,400 or 1,200 calories, but still get all the proteins and nutrients that you need, then you animals, but presumably instead of people, they also get a certain amount of health benefit and seem that likely that they'll live a bit longer. In population, I think the Okinawa diet probably is something closest to it, and people in Okinawa, Japan, tend to live a bit longer.
Right.
And they have some drugs now coming down the pike which seem to get to the core of that effect and may be able to do it without the dieting, which a lot of people can't get the willpower to do. So if you just pop a pill that gives you that effect, then you can actually live longer, be younger, say, instead of starting to decline, you know, 50, 60, or whatever, you push that back 5, 10 years. They've also been finding that that effect may be related to the mitochondria, the little energy factories of cells, and that mitochondria effect is one of the 7 pillars of the SENS research work, the
Aubrey de Grey. Yeah, we've had him on Fast Forward Radio in the past.
Right. So my point is he's making some progress there along about 3 or 4 of those procedures, and you know, and not too long, hopefully, you know, 10, 20 years, something like that. They could get some significant procedure of that to extend lives significantly.
I'm glad to hear you say it's within 10 years or so. I've kind of been on record for a while saying, you know, being one of the more optimistic people in this way, saying that I think that we'll see some form of life extension within a decade. Now, you know, it might even be labeled as something else, you know, a treatment for some disease of the, you know, of the elderly or something, but in effect actually reverses the clock in some way.
Right, and I'm saying just the early versions of it, I'm expecting to go in 10, 20 years. I expect it to be something that hopefully will be continuing to improve and develop upon all the time. But I'm expecting, you know, based on looking at the work, they seem to be getting pretty good progress on at least 1 or 2 things, which seem likely to come out in some form early. And again, I'm expecting that any delays with the FDA to get jumped over via other countries, have the medical tourism where people can fly over to Thailand or Malaysia or whatever and get treatments, or China. And so I'm expecting those kind of things to help accelerate it so that if the U.S. is trying to slow it down, that these other methods will, not other ways, but other pathways will be available.
Now, these treatments that mimic calorie restriction, mimic the benefits of that, how dramatic of results do we expect to see for those kinds of things? Will people who are well advanced in years benefit from them? Is it something that would primarily help people who are maybe younger or young middle-aged? If it does help folks who are a little bit older, does it actually help them to move back in time a little bit, as it were, or is it not that far along?
No, I think the calorie restriction effects, I think if you're, you know, particularly unhealthy, then maybe it could help make you a bit healthier. But, it, you know, just like eating right and exercising kind of thing. But someone doesn't really roll back the clock, I think, that dramatically in terms of actually reversing a lot of damage. It might be like someone saying, let me think. In my analogy, of course, I could be wrong, but I'm just, my intuition is that it'd be like someone who smoked a lot, they stopped smoking, and now they would live longer than if they had kept smoking, but they don't necessarily reverse all the lung damage. Although some of the effects go away because you're not abusing your body as much. So if someone get the effect of a better diet from a pill, then they stop doing the damage of a bad diet, and now they're on a good, healthier diet, so they live longer than they would otherwise, and they probably feel better. So I would expect that kind of effect. So that, because I'm expecting this to give maybe 5 to 15 years, depending upon what kind of shape you're in. Because one of the things that needs to be bear in mind is that there is quite a discrepancy in life expectancy now. Like some people in Japan, some women live on average 86 years, but then you can go down to some other fairly well-developed countries, well, just the U.S., 80 years for women. So U.S. women are 6 years behind, and the men are 75. So they're 10 years behind the longest-lived women. So, and then there's a lot of countries even worse than that. So, and of course, there's variation between states and different populations and that kind of stuff. So this boost, which might give, say, on average, a 10-year boost, for some, it may only boost 5, for others, 15 or 20, depending upon how much of this they're being helped by. Because some may already be pretty good in it, and they won't give, they may not get any effect, actually.
Well, you know, 5 or 10 years may not sound like much, but that's all the time in the world to someone who's, you know, pushing 80 or something.
That's right. And if you're trying to take care of yourself, but I don't think it would be necessarily 5 to 10 for someone at that advanced age. I think maybe you're getting another 2, 3, 4. It depends because this I was looking at some presentation by Chris Heward from the Kronos Foundation at the recent Foresight Unconference, and he was indicating these kind of trend lines where you track biomarkers. And it's the thing that's you can have a lot of different things like your heart condition, your neurological condition, various other things. And if any one of them, you know, kidney function or something, if any one of them gets below a critical point, then of course you're dead because you really needed that thing. So when you're intervening to slow down the damage, because what this current research for calorie restriction would be slowing down the damage, you would intervene, the earlier you intervene, the better. But so it's kind of unpredictable about how much you could get, each individual could get helped by it, because it depends upon what condition you're in each of the different aspects.
Oh, that makes sense. But the other advantage, of course, is that even if you get a couple or 3 years out of it, if that stepping stones you to the next, if I can use that as a verb, to the next advance, if that gets you far enough to where some nanotechnological or gene therapy or something else that's going to help move you along, then that was the amount of time you needed. So
that's right.
So it seems that every incremental bit helps. Now I want to shift gears quickly because we're running close on time, and I wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity to talk about the big picture. One of the things you had talked about was how societal forces can cripple the development of technologies, and you gave the example of the space program, where advanced, no big meaningful thing has occurred there. And what we need to do when we're looking as a society at what we're going to do with technology is, you know, what are the choices we can make? Not necessarily the safest choices we can make, but the choices that we can make that are going to lead us to a radically better future. And with the time we have left, maybe you could outline for a few of us what are those choices? What are those things that we should be thinking about doing, or that we should actively be pursuing, if we want to see things change dramatically for the better?
The thing we can dramatically do for the space program. My thing there is that right now it's very much about jobs on the ground for in certain congressional or Senate districts and not about achieving something meaningful in space. Otherwise, there wouldn't be, once they realize all the problems with the space shuttle and the space station, there wouldn't be a reason to keep supporting it technologically or for society. And my thinking there is that if you use more robotics to build things up, then people can follow later. Basically, by trying to do everything now with the MAN program, you're just making everything more expensive and slower. Also, you have to get rid of the chemical rocket engines and really be willing to use nuclear power to get your propulsion up there, because nuclear propulsion would work. They had a lot of work done in the 60s and 70s and earlier, which show that would have, you know, you could launch basically a million tons to anywhere in the solar system, and that's like these super container ships that they were sitting around the ocean now. And a lot of the problems with the space program are that it's not designed properly to the scale of the effort just isn't there if you really want to achieve something. My example on that is that when Columbus first came over to America, his second trip he went with 12 ships, each with hundreds of people, and that was just the vanguard of another wave of a lot of fleets of ships with a lot of people to actually start the colonization. And that is the kind of level of effort and level of movement you need in order to really achieve something meaningful in space. Like, if you're saying, I'm going to send three people on a camping trip for a week, yeah, nothing's going to happen. So the scale of the effort that you're making has to match up with actually achieving something. You know, space program's great, but you're not doing anything with it.
I suppose another path could be the space elevator. If you're putting up enough, if you have a space elevator where you can put up stuff cheaply all the time,
right?
Even though it would probably be, you know, small containers, each container that you put up there would be relatively small, but I guess the thing is, you get enough stuff up there to do something interesting up there.
I think the space elevator is a great idea. I think more can be done even before you get a space elevator, because a space elevator, especially one for Earth, is basically pushing the limit of even any proposed technology like carbon nanotubes. Basically, you're pushing the limit on that in order to achieve it. You know, still it is achievable, seems achievable to me, but there's like the recent climber work they were doing, where they have basically something climbing at a meter per second, and they're having to climb up to, I forget what it was, like 200 meters or 100 meters, whatever it was, on a on a cable, and they had a bunch of problems with wind. And basically, if you're going to go with a space elevator, it has to go all the way through the atmosphere and up around 300 miles or so, you're going to get through the jet stream and stuff. So your climber is going to have to be able to handle these super gale force winds, which I think is achievable, but there is, so the material, the carbon nanotubes are just barely strong enough, and you have to have a climber that can climb through gale force winds. I think we can do that, but the end goal is to have this system for putting material in space for the cost of electricity. And there are other ways to do that, which I like better. Laser arrays, where basically you take, currently we have solid-state lasers, which are almost at 100 kilowatts of power. They're using the military is trying to develop those. In order to launch something major into space, you probably need a billion watts, gigawatt, which you probably need to hook up one or two or three nuclear reactors to achieve. You have to have more power because you're going to lose some in your transmission. But then if you only have 100 kilowatt lasers, how do you use all that power? You use 100,000 of them or 10,000, whatever the number is, and then you can use that to launch payloads for very low cost in terms of you're keeping most of your power and stuff on the ground, and then you're only sending up payload and plus a minimal container, and you're not bringing along a bunch of chemical propulsion. And then if you use mirror reflection, which has recently been done by someone of Korean descent, the mirrors can bounce the light between them, and you can basically recycle your photons several thousand times, and again, reduce your power requirement. So I think those kinds of alternative approaches to getting to orbit could be done sooner than the space elevator, which I think is at least 20 to 35 years out.
I love this idea of using laser beams to shoot rockets into space. I think I mentioned at the UN conference what a compelling image that is. I think that's the kind of idea people could really get excited about. I'd like to see that get more coverage and get more attention. Brian, we're a little bit past our time, but I wanted to throw one last question at you. But there was one other idea that I couldn't let your time here go unpassed. Could you take just a moment and explain how it is that a futurist is similar to the Tom Hanks character in Saving Private Ryan?
Okay, so I was thinking that the Tom Hanks character, he's coming onto Omaha Beach, and there's a bunch of soldiers who are hiding behind the steel cross on the beach because, of course, they're naturally scared of all the people who are, the Germans who are shooting and killing them. And they feel that the steel crosses there will save their lives. But Tom Hanks points out that Captain Miller points out that if they stay there, they will die. That basically every position on the beach has been pre-sighted, and everyone who's there will die eventually. If you're hiding there, you just stay alive a little longer, but you're going to die. So my thinking on that is kind of analogous to that we as a society, as a civilization, all 6.5 billion people, are basically on a beach facing these challenges of limited lifespan, of air pollution, of all these problems, which we currently know are going to get each and every one of us eventually. 70-year lifespan, 100-year lifespan, that's all we're going to get. And if we stay on the beach, that's all we're going to have. And what we have to do is we have to be willing to take risks and get off the beach to press onwards to more technology and to greater capability. And in that analogy, the Tom Hanks Captain Miller character led a team that assaulted a pillbox that was keeping them pinned down. They also had to clear through a bunch of razor wire and other things to get there. And those were risks involved. He lost men trying to make that assault. But that was the only way out. And when he punched through, everyone was able to follow through. They had made their opening. So I feel that is what, as a futurist, you're identifying, hey, there's the pillbox. If we're creative about getting it, using our rays of lasers or using some other technology, we can get into space, we can extend our lifespans, we can do things that get us as a society, as a world, off this doomed beach. So
I think it's an apt analogy because I think it answers the Luddites, that would complain. Well, it's technology that got us here on the beach, and now we're in trouble because of technology. What we need to do is, go back in the ocean or something. That's not really the answer, is it? I mean, in order to deal with the problems we have today, we need to push forward.
That's right. That basically, the talk about the Luddites of giving up technology, it's too late for that. That basically, none of those approaches will keep the 6.5 billion and the extra 2 billion people that are coming over the next few decades alive. And basically saying that is, you're saying, well, we should then slaughter people down to the supportable, quote-unquote supportable 1 billion people that could handle the old technology. And that seems like a horrendous
yeah.
plan.
There is actually a misanthropic subculture of Luddites that would actually say, well, that sounds fine to me. But, most sane people would say, no, we got, what we got to do is press forward.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's great that we got folks like you, Brian, helping to kind of point out that way forward. Well, listen, we so appreciate you being on the show. We know we've kept you past the time that we had discussed, but we hope that we can invite you back and have you on again at some point in the future.
That sounds great. I'm very happy to be able to speak to you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much, Brian. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Well, that was some fascinating stuff. What a great guest. I guess we're talking, and it's just too much material ever to fit into the time frames that we leave on the show. But I think we could have gotten a lot deeper into both the human augmentation. Obviously, he had a lot to say on the subject of space as well. So maybe we'll have him back and talk.
I hope so. I got the impression we were just scratching the surface with him.
I think so.
Yeah, that's great.
Actually, I'd like to do a whole show just on this using lasers to shoot rockets into space. That is such an interesting new idea. It's just something I've learned about.
Well, the only thing I've ever heard about with the lasers and rockets involved, again, the space elevator, using, you know, lasers to power the, you know, the climbers on the space elevator. But you guys weren't talking about that, were you?
No, I mean, that's cool, too, but that's not nearly as dramatic as this idea of a laser actually being, I mean, a rocket actually being propelled out into space with a laser beam. That is just... That is cool stuff.
Yeah, right.
Well, I know we got a couple other things we need to do. Last week we talked about the question of getting into the transporter.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned that maybe a later start because the transporters for material objects, non-living things, were calibrated to molecular resolution, whereas the ones that transport human beings and presumably any other living thing are calibrated to quantum resolution. And now you've got Stephen, but you've got some objection to what I said about it.
Yeah, well, no objection to what you said, because that's absolutely the way it was presented in the show, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Star Trek talked about quantum resolution. My whole thing is that's an oxymoron.
How so?
Yeah, well, you know, jumbo shrimp, quantum resolution. Things that are quantum are by definition unresolved. You can't resolve what's going on at the quantum level. Is it waves? Is it particles? We know that the motion is this, but can we say with certainty, you know, where it is? You know, that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think if I'm doing a demonstration here now. I've picked up my coffee mug and I've set it back down on the table. I hope everyone listening can picture that, right? Now, didn't I collapse a quantum wave when I picked that up and set it down? I mean, the resolution occurs when you collapse the waveform, I believe.
Well, I think that there's still uncertainty. I think that always at the quantum level there's uncertainty. And now, I'm not saying that there's any uncertainty about you picking up the cup or putting it down. But at the quantum level,
I could have been lying about the whole thing.
Well, that's true. But let's assume that you're being perfectly truthful about your coffee cup.
Okay.
And but we don't know what's going on at the atomic level with certainty. That's what you're talking about. Is below the atomic level, actually at the quantum level, you know what is happening at the quantum level within that cup. And,
and I guess what they were saying in Star Trek, by use of the word resolution, which maybe is an inaccurate word, but I guess what they were saying was the transporter was, in effect, a quantum camera, and whatever those quantum states were, whatever their level of being collapsed or not, was being reflected on the other side of the transporter. So,
right.
So
you're doing
mapping. Right.
And there's a physicist who stated basically that this was impossible, and his name was Heisenberg.
Right.
And of course, they come up with something on Star Trek that they called with the transporter that they called the Heisenberg compensator. And the old joke about the Heisenberg compensator is, you know, apparently somebody, you know, was on set, some geek like you or I, you know, goes on set and asks the producer of the show, well, how does the Heisenberg compensator work? And the answer is, very well, thank you. And so basically, you know, reality check, this is fiction.
That's a pretty good answer. I have another answer to that question.
What's that?
How does the Heisenberg compensator work?
Yeah.
Well, I would tell you, but then I'd have to kill a cat.
oh, yeah. Schrodinger's cat, right?
yeah, exactly. Okay, so let me follow up your joke with a riddle. It's not really a riddle, but it's a trivia question. What, Stephen, is the largest object in the solar system?
Well, I almost jumped and said Jupiter, but the sun, right?
the sun ought to be the biggest object in the solar system. That would be an easy trivia question normally, and I just picked this news up today. I guess it's a couple days old, but apparently no. The comet Holmes is now bigger than the sun. It has expanded tremendously in size, and if you count both the core of the comet and its entire halo around it, not the tail, just the atmosphere, outer atmosphere of the comet, it is now actually a little bit bigger than the sun. So for
wow.
the time being, anyway, we currently have an object in the solar system bigger than the sun. We've got a...
Do we have a picture that we can share?
We do have a picture that can be shared. It's if you follow the link from the show notes, and we can also take that picture, I think, and probably reproduce that on the Speculus. So that is some
that's great. Well,
exciting stuff.
Yeah, which brings us to that point. We have in at the Speculist, and that's our web blog. That's Speculist. We keep show notes of all these shows and the topics we cover. We have links to the various topics we cover, including today's music. We have,
what have we got tonight?
Well, let's see. This Marginal Profits. Actually, no, that's not correct. We have Five Star Fall is the name of this band, and the album is Automatic Ordinary, and the song is What Planet Are We On? Which seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Absolutely appropriate, considering the discussion about uncertainty and quantum resolution and what's the biggest item in the solar system. So
it seems to fit at all, doesn't it?
It fits right in.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I hope you enjoy it, and it was another great show, Phil.
Look forward to listening to that music, and look forward to talking with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Thanks, Stephen, and good night.
And next Sunday night, right?
We'll be on.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Find you. What planet are we on today? I never felt. That was track number 2 from the album Automatic Ordinary by Five Star Fall from Magnatune.com.